Okay, good morning. This is Bio 241 and it's March 17th. We're going to finish up the sensory chapter and move on to endocrinology today. And I think last time, did you have a test last time? Yeah, okay, so your grades are on Blackboard and you'll get your tests back today in lab. And generally speaking, everybody did well. Well, I don't want to say everybody, but on average, people did really well on this test. I enabled the statistics tracking on Blackboard so you can at least see in your section what the average and median was and whatever. I think there's one section that was not quite as high as some of the others, but if you're to look at all my sections, the grades were pretty high, which is good. This is about the time of the semester people learn how to start studying for this kind of class and realize you just can't come to lecture, but you got to put time in outside of lecture, and if you study what I recommend, then usually you can do pretty well on the test as long as you have time to study. Okay, so congratulations for you guys. Some people brought up their grades by 25 points on this last test, so that's pretty amazing. Congratulations to all of you for that. And if you're still kind of at a loss to know what to study for the test, then you got to see me during office hours, and we can go over what it is exactly what it is that you need to study once again. Okay. All right, so I'm still trying to plan on having a test before spring break, which is April 6th, so that probably is going to be maybe a Thursday on that week, all right, before that. So that's going to be, let's see, that's going to be April 2nd. I only have my Monday, Wednesday schedule with me. Okay, so let's get started with finishing up the census chapter, but does anybody have any questions? Questions on the sensory chapter so far? Okay, well, we still got to talk about two kinds of senses, that's hearing and vision. And what are these senses? Are they general senses or special senses, vision and hearing? Special. They're special, yeah. Why do you call them special? Because you have that perception only in two locations in your body, right? You have two ears, two eyes, and they're very specialized organs, so we call those special senses. All right, so we were talking about hearing last time when we quit. And come on, Mr. Cursor. All right, and actually before we got to hearing, we were talking about some other senses that involve the ear. And it had to do with senses of the vestibule. All right, what senses contain in the vestibule, right where I have the cursor? Okay, equilibrium, which kind of equilibrium? There were two kinds. Yeah, linear acceleration. And then we talked about the other kind of acceleration that utilizes the semicircular canals. And what's that? Okay, that is what we call kinetic equilibrium. All right, so the vestibule right here is linear acceleration for static equilibrium because you actually don't have to be moving because gravity acts as an acceleration on your body, even though you're not moving. That's the way gravity works. That's from the utricle and saccule in the vestibule. And the semicircular canals are for what? Twisting or twirling kind of motion, which is what? Angular acceleration. We call that kinetic equilibrium. All right. And then I think we're talking about the cochlea right here. And why is the cochlea all wrapped up on itself like that? So it doesn't stick out your ears, right? That's why it's kind of rolled up like that. So that through evolution, it made it shorter, so it doesn't require so much of a long space inside your head. All right, so sound vibrations come in. Oh, I know what I want, why I went over the equilibrium senses. What part of the ear is responsible for static and kinetic equilibrium? Is it the outer ear, the middle ear, or inner ear, or all the above, or to the above? Which part? Which part or parts? Only the inner ear, right? Only the inner ear. So the inner ear starts at the oval window right here and includes the whole vestibular apparatus. So equilibrium is provided to you only via the vestibular apparatus, and that is the vestibule and the semicircular canals. Now, what about for the sense of hearing? What parts of your ear do you need for hearing? And again, the answers would be external ear, middle ear, or internal ear, or inner ear. As a matter of fact, you need all of them, right? So you won't be able to hear anything if that tympanic membrane doesn't vibrate back and forth. If you don't have bones in your middle ear, you won't be able to hear anything. And if you have a diseased cochlea, you won't be able to hear anything either. So you need all three parts. You need external, middle, and inner for hearing. All right. Also, what kind of receptor cells were in the maculae for static equilibrium? What's the receptor cell? Can you remember? I'm not going to show you a picture. What was the receptor cell for static equilibrium? Oh, somebody said it. I guess I am going back a little bit. All right, what kind of cells are those, the receptor cells? Those are hair cells. What about for kinetic equilibrium? They are? Ah, you haven't looked at this since, I don't know, ever maybe. Okay, what kind of cells are those? Those are? It says right there. Yeah, they're hair cells. What's wrong? What's wrong? Is anybody out there? Okay. All right, so now we're going to talk about the cochlea. So remember, sound comes in the external auditory meatus, vibrates the tympanic membrane back and forth above and below atmospheric pressure, and you have atmospheric pressure in the middle ear because of this eustachian tube equalizes pressure on either side of the tympanic membrane as long as you don't have a cold or a stuffy nose or something. All right, and then the auditory ossicles vibrate back and forth, and then the stapes pushes on the oval window that introduces that sound pressure wave into the cochlea. And that's the sound pressure wave that you actually hear. The thickest part of the cochlea is where I have the cursor right now. It's the tip, it's the very middle part of the cochlea right here. That's the thickest part. All right, so let's unroll the cochlea and take a look and see what happens. All right, so we've unrolled the cochlea, and here's the tympanic membrane. Here are the auditory ossicles. What compartment of the ear contains the auditory ossicles? That's the middle ear. Yeah, that's the middle ear. And then don't forget, the stapes vibrates the oval window, and that introduces sound pressure into the cochlea. And the cochlea is filled with fluid. And the reason why you have the different sizes, right, a large tympanic membrane and a small oval window, and this lever action right here is because, did I tell you last time why that is? Why this works as, you could think of it as an amplifier, because it's very difficult for sound to enter a water environment. Sound likes to just bounce off of it. And maybe you've been swimming, or next time you go swimming, have somebody talk to you outside of the pool, like on the deck or something, and then put your head underwater, and what happens? Even though they're talking to you, the sound kind of disappears because sound has difficulty entering an aqueous environment. And so this acts like a little amplification system, and actually it's a little impedance matching device so that the energy that's in air actually can end up as energy inside the fluid. What do we call that fluid in the inner ear? That is endolymph, right? That is endolymph. All right, so now you have that sound energy, and remember, sound can be characterized by its frequency, right? So sound is a wave. So I'll put two frequencies right here, here, and here. Which is a higher frequency? Can you tell? The top one is higher frequency, and the low one is lower frequency. And I drew it so that the amplitude sort of looks the same. All right, so the amplitude is going to be from here to here, and here to here, and that will give you the loudness or the intensity of that particular sound. So if all of a sudden this wave shrunk down to this size, what can you tell me about the frequency? It's the same, right? But now the sound is going to be, what, a lot softer because the intensity or the amplitude is decreased. All right, so high frequencies produce a high pitch, and low frequencies produce a low pitch, right? And frequencies in between would have intermediate sound to you. Okay. So now we got the sound pressure inside that endolymph, and it enters the cochlea, and it can hop across this middle canal inside the ear. And you can probably remember these things from anatomy. This top canal right here is the scala vestibuli, which is connected to the oval window. There is a fluid-filled canal in the middle, and we call this the cochlear duct. And then there's another canal right here, which is called the scala tympani. And so sound can enter the scala vestibuli, go across the cochlear duct into the scala tympani, and then it can, that energy can escape your inner ear. How can that energy escape your inner ear? And why is it important that that sound energy can escape your inner ear? Yeah, that's interesting. You might be hearing it over and over and over again if it's just running around in there, reflecting off of everything. So it might produce a buzz or something. But if a lot of sound energy enters the ear, remember it's a mechanical wave, it might actually blow up the cochlea, right? Or might damage, mechanically damage the cochlea. And then, of course, you wouldn't hear anything. So where is the pressure relief valve? And that is the round window right here. So that can bulge out and that can release the sound energy from the inner ear. So that's an important structure. And as the sound traverses the cochlear duct right here, it's going to stimulate some receptor cells. All right? And the way that the cochlea is stimulated is by frequency. So we've unrolled the cochlea right here, but let's look at the cochlea from the top down, not into the slide, but let's look down from the top, down on top of the cochlea. So we've unrolled it. Now we're looking down on top of it. And this is what the shape of the cochlea will look like from a top-down view. All right, and then this is the end. What do we call the end? I maybe mentioned this last time, but it's on the slide. What do we call the tip of the cochlea when you look at it on that projection? It's called the, what is this? Helicotrema, right? That's the tip of the cochlea. But if you look at it in this perspective, which is the widest part of the cochlea? Is it near the tympanic membrane or is it by the helicotrema? Yeah, it's by the helicotrema. That's the widest part of the cochlea. All right, so if you look at something like this, and maybe, you know, we could put some strings going across like that. What kind of musical instrument does that remind you of? Xylophone, maybe? Yeah, that's good, because the size of the keys change when you play a xylophone. But what's that, what's another musical instrument that that's maybe? A harp, for instance, where you have really thin, short strings over here. What's another musical instrument? Now, instead of standing up, you'd have to lay it down like that or stand it up like that, but still the string arrangement is just exactly like that. How about a piano? Who's seen a piano ever on the inside? Yeah, probably a couple people. All right, and if you hit a key on one side of the piano, what do you get? You get, if you vibrate one of these really short strings, it becomes a high frequency, and if you hit a string on the other side, what does it become? A really, really low frequency. All right, so the size of things that vibrate determine the frequency at which that they will vibrate at. All right, so structure corresponds to function in that sense. So inside the cochlea, what do you really have? You really have something that's like a piano inside both cochlea, so that when a certain note comes in, it will vibrate a particular part of the cochlea, and when it vibrates, these cells will send signals to the cerebral cortex and you will have a perception of that particular note as a result of that. All right, so the regions that are closest to the tympanic membrane are responsible for high frequencies, right? And so 20,000 hertz, that's very, very high frequency. Maybe in lab you've taken out the audiometer. Has anybody worked with the audiometer in lab yet? No? Okay. I'll see if you guys can do that. And then the end over here, which is the helicotrema, is going to be stimulated by very low frequencies. And we see about 500 hertz in this region right here. And then the part of the cochlea in the middle is going to be stimulated with what? Like mid-range frequencies. Like voice is typically around 1,000 hertz or so. All right, so the space or the location within the cochlea will be stimulated depending on what the frequency is. All right, so these cells then will send information to the brain. So probably you should know, right, this endolymph within the scala vestibuli, as well as the scala tympani right here, and then there's another fluid called endolymph inside the cochlear duct. Okay. All right, so how does the cochlear duct then, or actually structures within the cochlear duct, how does that send signals to the brain? All right, so here's the scala vestibuli, here's the scala tympani right here. So sound comes in the vestibuli, leaves the tympani, but it can also go across this region right here depending on the frequency. Right, if this was by the helicotrema of the cochlea, what frequencies would be able to go across these membranes right here? It would be, what, low frequencies. If it was closer to the tympanic membrane, it would only be high frequencies. So when sound energy comes in, it's going to vibrate this tectorial membrane. It kind of looks like a gelatinous mass that we saw in the crista ampullaris and the maculae, sort of looks like it. And what's attached to it? The stereocilia from, guess what kind of cells these are? Now I know you guys don't want to tell me today, but you just have to tell me. Go ahead. What kind of cells do these look like? They're a little small, but they're hair cells. Okay, not cells that make hair that we have on our head, but nonetheless, here are hair cells. These are the receptor cells that have these stereocilia on them, and they're attached to the tectorial membrane. So when the tectorial membrane starts to vibrate back and forth, guess what happens to these cells? They generate generator potentials, right? Because these are just mechanical receptors, and those generator potentials can trigger action potentials in the auditory nerve that takes those signals to the temporal lobe, for instance, for your perception of that particular tone. Okay, so this piece right here is what we call the organ of Corti. I don't know why it's in parentheses, right? From anatomy, you know that's the organ of Corti right there. All right, and what's the cell that's in the organ of Corti responsible for your sense of hearing? That's a hair cell, right? Okay. So here's a nice enlarged view of the organ of Corti. Here you can see those hair cells, and there's different locations of hair cells that respond to different intensities of sound, but nonetheless, all of these cells right here are going to respond to one particular frequency the best compared to other frequencies. All right, and then these axons carry that information to the temporal lobe, and then you have the perception of tone that's based on what region of the cerebral cortex gets stimulated by those action potentials. What is the language that your central nervous system works on that understands? Action potentials. All right, so it's your brain won't hear the symphony. It will just hear, what, a series of action potentials going to different locations in the brain. And again, the location in the brain is arranged just like the cochlea is arranged. So there will be one part of your cerebral cortex that will respond to low frequencies. Right? When it's stimulated, you will have the perception of low frequencies. When another part of the auditory cortex is stimulated with, what is a cortex stimulated with? Action potentials. Right? So when another region of the auditory cortex gets stimulated by action potentials, you'll hear another tone or a different tone. And then over here, right, another part of the auditory cortex, you'll hear high frequencies. So actually, in your temporal lobes, what do you have in your temporal lobes? You have like a piano, right, inside your temporal lobes. Again, that give you the perception of different tones. And then what would a chord be? What would a chord be? It would be some pleasant arrangement of maybe three different tones that you perceive on your cortex. All right, so that's, for instance, what a chord would be. So your ear is kind of a fascinating organ, and basically probably the way you should think of it is as a piano. And the keys are connected up to your auditory cortex by axons, and the way that that information is transmitted is in the form of action potentials. And as the intensity increases of a particular frequency from here to here, how is that increase in intensity presented to your cerebral cortex so that you have an appreciation of a change in intensity? I'm not quite sure I heard. Somebody take a stab at it. You don't have to sing, just tell me. So if there's a higher amplitude of stimulus, which is sound in this particular case, How is that, how does your cerebral cortex understand that the intensity of that sound stimulus is increasing? If the intensity is increasing?
The action potential is increased.
Okay, what about an action potential? The amplitude of an action potential? The frequency of action potentials going to that location in the brain increases, right? So you get more action potentials in that part of the brain, and the sound sounds what? Louder as a result. As the frequency of action potentials decreases, then the sound sounds more soft. Okay. So, I think, you know, this is not an exam figure, but the only thing that I really want you to know is probably there is a relay station for most sensory information before it goes to the cerebral cortex. So here's the temporal lobe. And let's just say that this is nerves from the middle part of the organ of Corti. It's going to this middle part of the auditory cortex, and then this part over here is going to be responsible, say, for low frequencies. So over here, if we stimulate this area, what would be your perception if we stimulate this area, say, electrically? You're going to hear something of a high frequency as a result. So in your temporal lobes, you really have what? You have a piano over here as well, and over here as well. And the relay center is always the thalamus for signals moving into the cerebral cortex. Okay, and I think that's all I want to talk about. Oh, no, not quite. All right, so let's recapitulate. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? Yeah. Okay, if you stimulate the auditory cortex manually, okay. You know, I don't think we know how to do that just yet, but because there's some learning that has to be involved with that. But for instance, yeah, if we were to take a very young person, of course this is highly unethical to even, but we can do a thinking experiment, right? And if we could put three tiny wires in somebody's temporal lobe in the auditory cortex right here, right, and we knew exactly what sounds were going to be produced or perceived, right, and if we stimulated these three different areas of the temporal lobe very discreetly, then that person, as they grew up, would learn to appreciate a chord, which is made out of three notes, right, and even without any kind of sensory input, right, and that would be really interesting to do that kind of thing for instance, if somebody has a congenital malformation of their cochlea. Okay, and then they would be able to hear. They would learn how to interpret their environment. Right? So there are cochlear implants right now that people can get that don't stimulate the brain directly. They will work as long as the auditory nerve is working. Okay, but this person still has to relearn how to hear things, and that's a very difficult process to relearn how to perceive your environment through, even if it was a normal cochlea. Okay, it's probably even more difficult for vision. All right, so there were people who were able to restore their vision, and at a later time in their life, and so their eyes began to work again, but they had gone past that point of development, so they were really never able to see, but they could see light, but they couldn't interpret images to know exactly what they were. Okay, like they couldn't probably ever read again, but they might recognize family members somehow or another, but they wouldn't get a lot of fine detail from their visual senses. So there's that learning process you have to go through. Yeah. Yeah?
Which produces
your perception of?
Different
pitches of sound. So a pitch would be, say, a frequency or a tone. Yeah, we could use that different language to talk about.
So then how would the different pitches be differentiated?
By just location in the cerebral cortex.
Whatever
part of the cerebral cortex is receiving action potentials, that's going to correspond to a particular pitch in your brain. Okay? And so if only one region is stimulated, you will hear a tone. If maybe there are three regions that are stimulated, then you're going to, and if it's the right arrangement, then that's going to sound like a chord or something. And if the arrangement isn't just right, then it's going to be what, very unharmonious kind of sound, but some kind of chord, some kind of dissonant chord.
But that's relayed
by the cochlea? Yeah, that's those action potentials start in the cochlea, in particular the organ of Corti, and then the action potentials come in, right, via the auditory nerve to the medulla, where they're split up. In the medulla, they go to the midbrain. What is this dark area called? These dark areas right here. These are actually, you could think of these as a ganglion. These are a group of nerve cell bodies and dendrites, but in the central nervous system, we call that a nucleus. Okay, so this is a nucleus. In the peripheral nervous system, we would call that a ganglion. All right, so there's a synapse here because we have what? Nerve cell bodies. So the sound comes in, the medulla goes to the midbrain, and remember there's a couple bumps in the midbrain that we would call the inferior colliculus. Sound information is used in the midbrain to tell what direction sound is coming from. All right, so with your eyes closed, if somebody opened and closed a door, and if all the doors sounded the same when they opened and closed, you could tell with your eyes closed if it was that door that was opening, or that door, or this door down over here, depending on how sound reached your ears. Since you have two ears, sound is going to reach one ear before the other, and you would be able to tell what direction that sound was coming from, and that occurs in the inferior colliculus right here of the midbrain. Remember the corpora quadrigemina from anatomy? All right, so it would synapse here, and then it would go, another neuron would take that information to the thalamus, and what's the job of the thalamus? It directs sensory signals to the cerebral cortex to the proper location so that you have the proper sensation. All right, so if we took this neuron right here from the temporal lobe, so let's just say these are action potentials generated by the organ of Corti. If we were to unthread this axon from the temporal lobe and then route it to the occipital lobe, right, whenever sound would enter your ear and stimulate the organ of Corti, what would be your perception? Yeah, you would actually have some kind of visual experience. So those action potentials, instead of ending up in the auditory cortex, would end up in the visual cortex, and you would have some kind of visual experience. I don't think it would make any kind of sense to our reality that we know, but that's how your brain interprets information. Okay? So the reason why you hear something is because action potentials end up in the right part of your cerebral cortex, and that's partly determined by the thalamus that routes these signals relays the signals to the proper location.
When she was talking about the pitches, is she talking about amplitude or frequency?
Frequency. So amplitude only has to do with the loudness of the sound. Okay, so when the amplitude decreases, the sound gets softer. So pitches has to do with the frequency. Yeah. Or the tone. High tone, low tone. Yes. Some devices just can amplify sound. Some might actually kind of bypass the cochlea. Right? We would call that a cochlear implant. But I think most devices pretty much work by amplifying sound, but not sound across the spectrum. Now, when I say spectrum, what do I mean? Let's go back and look at this figure right here. So the spectrum would be from, what, maybe 20 hertz or hundreds of hertz all the way up to 20,000 hertz. And when people start to lose their hearing, they lose their hearing in the region of 20,000 hertz to probably even below 1,000, but they can hear low frequencies pretty well. So when somebody has a hearing aid, the frequencies that are amplified has to be tailored to the individual. So that when, for instance, somebody that has a hearing deficit, and let's pretend none of you have a hearing deficit, but we probably all have some kind of hearing deficit. But somebody that's deaf to some degree or another, when somebody speaks to them,
let's go refer to the quiz. So, okay, let's take a quiz right now. What do you say?
What did I say? Really hard to interpret. I said, well, let's take a quiz right now for fun. Okay? So somebody with a hearing deficit can hear things, but what's the information content? It's all muddled because it's only, what, low frequencies. So in order for you to understand everything, you need the proper balance of all frequencies, all the frequencies that make up the auditory spectrum. So somebody with a hearing aid, you might have to really boost up maybe the frequencies from 2,000 hertz and above.
So
okay.
The hearing device will be doing the job of the middle ear or the malleus?
You know, it depends on only where the problem is. You know, the problem might be in the organ of Corti, or maybe there is some decrepitus in the auditory ossicles right here. I'm not really sure. They just don't vibrate anymore at that particular frequency. I would say usually it's in the inner ear, though. Okay? Okay. So hearing aids have to be matched up. You can't just boost all signals, because then sound will just still sound muddy to them as a result of that. Okay. All right. Any other questions on hearing? Yeah. So you can hear a buzzing sound when they take it out. I don't know what that is. I don't know. Do they hear it when they do they hear a buzzing sound when they take it out too? Yeah. Yeah. No, I'm not sure I know what the buzzing sound is. Okay, if that's like a little alarm going off saying, your earpiece fell out of your ear or what, I'm not sure. Maybe low battery signal or time to reset the clock for daylight saving time. It's hard to tell what all these different things can mean anymore. Okay, that would be probably pretty obnoxious if they were to hear that all the time. Yeah. Yeah. You know, what it might be is some feedback. For instance, have you ever been to a concert or something? Or if I were to use a microphone here and say the speakers are here pointing down to you. So if I face the microphone that way, the sound is going over the microphone. But you got to point the microphone in this direction. And my head might be blocking the sound, but as soon as the microphone moves away, like if I tilt my head like that, the sound is going to go right into the microphone and it's going to be amplified. And it's going to come out of the speakers again into the microphone, and then the microphone amplifies it out the speakers again. That's what, a positive feedback? And you know what? That's what might be happening. When somebody takes a hearing piece out of their ear, now the microphone, there might be a microphone that picks up the sound, is feeding back to the amplifier. And it only works when it's in your ear, when your ear canal separates out the microphone from the amplifier, output of the amplifier. I would guess that's what's going on there. So it won't buzz in somebody's ear like that. Okay, but buzzing can be a problem. For instance, if the transducer isn't hooked up just right, you might have a deficit at 2,000 hertz, and then all of a sudden you hear just fine at 4,000 hertz, and you might go into an elevator that has a buzz at that particular frequency, and all of a sudden you have this huge, loud noise in your ear whenever you're in that elevator. Okay, if you have normal hearing, chances are everybody's voice would be really high-pitched. And if I was talking, then maybe you wouldn't even hear me. Okay, because I don't have a very high-pitched voice. Okay, so because you're compensating mostly for high frequencies right over here, not for low frequencies typically. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that's real important. Yeah, that's important to know. That has to do with that pharyngotympanic tube, all right? And remember, in anatomy, you can always join a couple structures together as long as you put an O between them. Here is the pharyngotympanic tube. It goes between what? The pharynx and your middle ear right here. Otherwise, we call it the eustachian tube or the auditory tube. We've got all different kinds of names for this tube. And the tympanic membrane can only vibrate back and forth nicely is if the pressure in the middle ear is the same as the pressure in the external ear. Because if the pressure in the middle ear was higher, it would just push the tympanic membrane out and hold it right all the way distended to the outside of your head. It wouldn't be able to vibrate. Or if the pressure outside the head was real high and low in the middle ear, the tympanic membrane would do what? It would bulge all the way to the inside and it couldn't vibrate. It would just be held up against the inner ear right here. So the pressure, the atmospheric pressure on either side of the tympanic membrane should be the same so that the membrane can do what? Can vibrate above and below atmospheric pressure. And whenever this tympanic membrane gets plugged up, then you experience a little bit of a hearing loss, maybe even some pain or pressure, especially if you're flying. And what you have to do is equalize the pressure by somehow opening up your eustachian tube by yawning or chewing gum or swallowing or something like that. Right, so have you ever done that on a, maybe even hold your nose and and you can hear air rushing up that tympanic membrane, eustachian tube. So this is the thing that gets plugged up, and of course it gets plugged up when you have otitis media, which is what, a ear infection, or if you have a cold or flu or something, this gets inflamed and that eustachian tube gets plugged up and you can't equalize your ears as a result. So if you're in the mountains, that could be a little bit painful, but for sure that's going to be painful, for instance, if you hop on an airliner someplace. And a lot of times little kids will misbehave terribly and cry and kind of throw a temper tantrum right as the plane is taking off and then descending because what's happening to them. What do little kids have a lot of times? Okay, they have, ear infections. You know, a lot of kids have ear infections, right? So this eustachian tube gets plugged up. They can't equalize pressure either side of the tympanic membrane. So as the airplane starts to go up in elevation or descend in landing, their ears feel like somebody's ripping them out, right? Because you could tell, like a six-month-old, would you want to give him some gum to chew? Probably not. How about if you say, oh, we'll just do a Valsalva maneuver. Hold your nose and compressurize your chest. Will they listen to you? They never listen to you, okay? But that's not their fault, right? So, you know, you just have to comfort them if they have a cold or an ear infection or something. So they're just experiencing. I don't think it ever really damages their ear, but I suppose it's possible to do that. If you have a child that has a cold or otitis media and you're going to fly someplace, you might want to talk to a physician and see if you can give them some medication, all right, to open up this eustachian tube right here to make them more comfortable, like maybe an antihistamine or something. But don't take my advice, right, because I'm not a clinician. Don't just automatically medicate somebody that's just a couple months old, right? Talk to somebody that knows about that. But that might help them through that period. Okay, vision. Any other questions about hearing? Oh, yeah, there was something else. All right, so what were the three senses important for the ear? The three senses. Yeah, okay. I'm beginning to. Okay, so hearing. What else? Equilibrium. Two kinds of equilibrium. Static. All right, and I'm just going to put EQ right here, and then kinetic. Kinetic. Equilibrium. All right, now, all of these senses are in the vestibular apparatus, which is a bony part of something that's inside what the petrous region of your temporal bone. And so let's write down what the bony labyrinth is for each of these three senses. What's the bony labyrinth? Uh-oh. I'm running out of marker. Bony labyrinth. What's the bony labyrinth for hearing? Okay, well, the ear is made up of the external, middle, and inner. Okay, that's really not what I'm thinking about. I'm actually thinking about the parts of the vestibular apparatus, the bony parts of the vestibular apparatus. And for hearing, it's a thing that looks like a snail. That's the cochlea. All right, the cochlea. What about for static equilibrium? Okay, I don't think it's clearly written in your book, so that's why I want to make a nice table for you. Right, this is the vestibule. What about the bony labyrinth for kinetic equilibrium? The semicircular canals. Yes. All right. Now, what about... Okay, what about the organs that are necessary? All right, so the organs for these various senses that are inside the bony labyrinths. What's the organ in the cochlea that allows you to hear? Organ of Corti. All right, that's one. What about for static equilibrium? This one's a little strange. I've mentioned it a lot of times. Your book doesn't have a really clear picture. That's the maculae. And the utricle and saccule are both maculae. All right. And then what about for kinetic equilibrium? What's the organ responsible for kinetic equilibrium? And you should have maybe a picture of where that is. But it's in the semicircular canals. What part of the semicircular canals? It's a little bulgy place at the end of a semicircular canal. What did we call that? It looks like a little ampule. And there's an organ inside that ampule. What's it called? It's really close. It's called the crista. Crista ampullaris. That's the crista ampullaris. All right, so those are the organs for those particular senses. All right, and then one last thing. What about the receptor cell? Receptor cell. For hearing, what's the receptor cell? Hair cell. Sounds strange. Are you sure about that? You should say yes. Okay. What about for static equilibrium? What's the receptor cell? Okay. I'll go along with that. Hair cell. What about for kinetic equilibrium? You're kidding me. You're not kidding me. You are right. It's a hair cell. All right, so the same receptor cell gives you this perception of sound, gives you perception of twirling, gives you the perception of linear acceleration. And is there anything common about those perceptions in your experience? No, sound has nothing to do with your sense of motion, right, in your everyday experience, but it uses what, the same kind of receptor cell, so you should be kind of impressed how evolution has provided different kinds of perceptions based on the same structure, right? Because now, how would you use to explain that a hair cell can produce all of these different modalities of perception? Because why?
They can move in different ways.
They're mechanical receptors, and hearing sound is a mechanical wave, and then twisting and gravity are mechanical kinds of events. But the reason is because these receptor cells just generate what? Action potentials, right? They all just generate action potentials. And the reason why you have different perceptions because these action potentials go to different locations in the brain to give you different perceptions. Okay? So I find it interesting that it's the same cell that gives you all that different kind of information depending on where it's hooked up. All right, vision. Vision picks up waves as well, but not sound waves. Sound waves are mechanical waves. Sound waves are increases and decreases in pressure as it moves through air. Vision picks up light waves, and light waves are electromagnetic radiation, a wave. It's a much different kind of thing. So what's varying are electrical and magnetic fields, and guess what? You don't have to know a thing about electromagnetic waves, except some are higher in frequency, some are lower in frequency, and that's what this slide right here shows you, is that very low frequency electromagnetic waves, and you can measure the length of this wave, okay, in terms of angstrom units right here, the low frequency waves are radio waves. You can't see radio waves. Then microwaves are a little bit longer. Then we have infrared that maybe you could feel as heat, but again, you can't see it with your eyes. Then here is the visible light spectrum, which is really narrow compared to the full electromagnetic spectrum right here. And then above that is ultraviolet, x-rays, and gamma rays. And what can you tell me about x-rays and gamma rays right here as compared to radio waves? Okay. Yeah, these are really high frequency. Okay. And also, as something increases in frequency, it increases in energy. So these electromagnetic waves are very high energy, and they're so high in energy they're actually damaging to biological tissue. All right, fortunately, we're never exposed to many of these kinds of things unless we go into a hospital and get an x-ray, for instance, for imaging purposes. Right, and you can't get x-rays every day of your life because that would kill those cells. Right, but radio waves, we're surrounded by radio waves all the time. Those aren't damaging to your body whatsoever. So some frequencies are damaging. Usually as you go up in energy, they're damaging. For instance, ultraviolet light, all right, can cause cancer because ultraviolet light can cause mutations in DNA. All right, so ultraviolet light is fairly high energy. And actually, you can use ultraviolet light to sterilize things if you wanted to. It'll kill viruses and bacteria, so that shouldn't be around anywhere that could be you could be exposed to. All right, but just below the ultraviolet spectrum, is the visible light spectrum. And so here is the visible light spectrum. What does it look like to you? It looks like a rainbow, exactly right. So visible light spectrum. As a matter of fact, let me go back up over here. All of these waves are emitted by the sun, right? And these are the waves that can penetrate our atmosphere right here. So this is a rainbow, but we just actually call that the visible light spectrum. And does anybody know what that little acronym is that describes what colors come next to each other in the rainbow? Yeah, like Roy G. Biv. I don't know what G stands for. I've never known any Biv. But anyway, that's somebody's name. And so what does that represent? That means red. Oh, I can't point to it. Can't get any lower. Red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, violet. All right? So this part over here is what? Like the red part, and then orange, and then yellow, green, blue, indigo, and violet. See? So I could tell. Okay. So that is the rainbow. So different colors are what? Different frequencies or different energies. Okay, and so this is what your eye can pick up. So let's talk about, and the eye can be broken down into structures that are responsible for vision, and then other structures that are what we call accessory structures, which is help vision, for instance, but not directly responsible for vision. All right, and so there's an anterior part of your eye that has the iris right here, and the iris can constrict, and it can also dilate depending on the light condition. So if it's very bright outside, the iris is going to constrict. If it's very dim, maybe sort of like in here, everybody's pupil is going to get very, very large. So the iris dilates as a result of that. And don't forget, the pupil is just a hole in the iris. It's not really a structure. It's just something that lets light into the eye. And the iris is a pigmented muscle, and so it blocks light from entering the eye. And so we see two different arrangements of fibers right here. We can see circular fibers and we can see radial smooth muscle fibers. So you can't control your pupil diameter. It's taken care of automatically for you. So sympathetic fibers, all right, stimulate these radial fibers right here, which pull on the circular fibers, which causes dilation. All right, now does that make sense in terms of the fight or flight response? What part of your autonomic nervous system is stimulated when you're presented with life-threatening kinds of perceptions? Your sympathetic nervous system. All right, and so what might be a reasonable response of your eyes? To close the iris so that you don't see very well, or to enlarge the pupil so that you can get a lot of light and perceive what's happening? Okay, so pupil dilation from the sympathetic nervous system because it causes contraction of these radial muscles. All right, parasympathetic, on the other hand, stimulates the circular muscles, and then when they contract, of course, that closes down the pupil, and that's what happens under very bright light conditions or when you're in a rest and repose stimulation from the parasympathetic nervous system. So you can see that the parasympathetic and sympathetics are antagonistic in this sense in terms of pupil constriction. And that's because of these two different arrangements. All right, there's something else that smooth muscle is used for in the eye. There's another circular smooth muscle. So here is the iris. Right? You might have to go back and review your anatomy of the eye. But here's the cornea. That's the outer anterior part of the eye. And then here is the anterior chamber filled with aqueous humor. And then here is the iris. That's what we were just talking about. All right, but there's another circular smooth muscle right here that we call the ciliary muscle, sometimes the ciliary body. And it can contract and relax. And when it contracts, guess what happens to this muscle? Just like when the circular muscles of the iris contract, right, down over here, what happens to the size of the pupil? It gets smaller, right? So when a muscle contracts, that circular muscle gets tighter, right? It cinches down, all right? So this sense right here, or this accessory operation, is called accommodation. And there are ligaments or tendons that go from the ciliary muscle that attach to the lens, right? And the lens is something that will help bend light so that light focuses on the retina. And why is it that you would like to have light focused on the retina? Because what would happen if light was not focused on the retina? Well, if you ever were to have a camera from years and years ago, before you would take a picture, you would always have to focus the lens so that it would be clear. Otherwise, everything would be blurry. All right, so that's the same for us. In order to see things clearly, this lens has to change shape in order for light that is coming from different distances from your face are focused on the retina. So the lens actually has to change shape, and the ciliary muscle can change the shape of the lens depending on the tension in these suspensory ligaments that are connections between the ciliary muscle and the lens. And that process is called accommodation. Now, did you talk about accommodation in lab? Yeah, a little bit. But you could do a little experiment right now. You could put your hand out at arm's length and look at your fingertip, right? Focus on your fingertip. And is your fingertip in focus? When you just focus on your fingertip, can you do that? If I get my bifocals just right, I can. It's in focus. Now, don't change your gaze. Look at your fingernail. What about everything in the background? All of a sudden, I have like 200 students because it's blurry, right? And I see all kinds of multiple images, right? So you can't focus on everything. You have to choose what distance away from your eye you want to focus on, all right? Now, put your finger back up and focus on something way behind your finger. Now, what can you tell me about your finger? And now you see maybe two fingers or a really blurry finger, but now everything behind it is in focus, right? So you can't get everything in focus. That process of selecting what you want in focus and then changing that distance is what we call accommodation. And that is due to the ciliary muscle right here pulling on the lens to change its shape. All right, and guess what happens as we get older? That lens gets stiffer. It doesn't like to change as fast. And then maybe there's a period of time where it just will stop changing shape altogether. So what ability do you lose as you get older? The ability to accommodate. Exactly right. Okay. So that partly explains why certain people drive on the freeways the way they do. Okay. And that is an elderly person, when they drive, how is it that they drive? It could be recklessly, but recklessly because on the 405, when you should be going like 75 or 80 miles an hour, how fast are they going? They're going like 20 miles an hour, right? Okay, and that's because they just can't accommodate very well anymore. For instance, if you're in like 75 years old and you're driving down the freeway, what's one thing you always want to be concerned about? You're driving down the freeway, you're concerned about? Cars next to you, yeah, but you know, they sort of can take care of you themselves, but you don't want to get a ticket because what's going to happen? Well, you're going to get your license pulled and you'll never be able to drive again, so you don't want to get a speeding ticket, right? So where are you looking when you're driving if you don't want to get a speeding ticket because it will change your life forever? Where are you looking? You're looking at your speedometer. Right, because you don't want a speeding ticket. So somebody is going to look at their speedometer and they're going to say, oh, I'm going 25 miles an hour. So you go, thank God, I can't get a speeding ticket. But where is your speedometer? It's really close to your face, right? So you go, okay, I'm not going to get a ticket, but then what's the next thing are you worried about? Your exit. You don't want to miss your exit, because if you miss your exit, what do you got to do? Oh, you got to stay on the freeway. That's like the last place in the world that you want to be, right? So then you look up from the speedometer and you look down the road to see if where your exit is, and what do you see? Well, you're focused close up, right? You're accommodated close up, and you look out the window, and then everything is blurry, right? And so it takes a while for that lens to change shape. So 1001, 1002, all of a sudden everything appears clear and in focus, and so you stop sweating and you go, oh, right, I didn't lose my exit yet, all right? But then a second later, what pops into your mind? Am I speeding? And you go, oh, geez, I don't want a ticket. I'll lose my license. So you look back down at your speedometer, and what do you see? It's all blurry because it takes a while to accommodate. 1001, 1002, then the speedometer becomes clear, and you see, okay, 22 miles an hour. I'm lucky. I'm not speeding. Okay, then what happens? Well, then you're worried about your exit again, and you look out the window, and what do you see? It's blurry, right? So that process just repeats itself, right, many, many, many times, and people drive that slow speed. So anyway, when you see those viejitos out there, just be really cautious and be kind to them because they just don't see things as well as us younger people do anymore. Because of what? Accommodation. They just can't accommodate as quickly anymore. All right, so be careful with them. All right, so here is your eyeball. All right, so here is the cornea. And what can you tell me about the shape of the cornea right here? Is it flat? No, it's curved. All right, and the shape of the lens is curved as well. All right, and as a matter of fact, its curvature can change depending on where you're trying to focus, up close or far away. And then it's the job of this ciliary muscle right here to either pull or relax on the suspensory ligaments that are attached to the lens. So when the and this is not really intuitive, but you probably might have to know this for the exam. When the ciliary muscle relaxes, all right, what happens to the shape of the ciliary muscle when it relaxes? It actually gets bigger. Okay, when it relaxes, the muscle gets bigger. When it contracts, it gets smaller. So when the ciliary muscle relaxes and it gets bigger, guess what happens to the tension on those suspensory ligaments? All right, let's make the ciliary muscle really big. What's going to happen to the tension on those ligaments? They're going to pull more, right? So it's kind of interesting because it's a circular muscle. When the muscle relaxes, that's when the tension increases on the suspensory ligaments, and that flattens out the lens. You see it's kind of flat over here? Okay. So usually when a muscle relaxes, the tension decreases on a tendon. That doesn't happen because this is a circular muscle. Now when the muscle contracts, all right, then that relaxes the tension on these suspensory ligaments, and the lens gets thicker and has more curvature on it. All right, so it's not really intuitive. You have to think about that. If that doesn't make sense, then maybe see me during office hours or something, but maybe I can explain it in a little bit different way. Okay, so we have a couple vision problems. If somebody has, I guess I want to go back to one other thing right here. All right, so you can see that the cornea has kind of a shape that looks like what? Looks like a lens. So the cornea can bend light to help focus on the retina. And indeed, the most important structure of your eye that focuses light on the retina is the cornea. It's really not the lens. It's the shape of the cornea that's the most important focusing element in your eye. What does the lens do? It only allows for accommodation, right? Because it can change shape. That has some important implications a little bit later on that I want to talk about, but I won't have that slide. So the cornea bends light, and then the lens will bend light, and if everything's in focus, all the light is going to come back to and focus on one point on the retina right here. We call that emmetropia. That's normal vision, when you see things clearly. All right, and if you have normal vision, you don't need any kind of correction. All right, hyperopia, on the other hand, is what we call farsightedness. That means light rays coming in from one object, right, don't get bent enough, and they actually converge and focus on a structure way behind the retina, way behind the eyeball. So in this particular case, somebody's eyeball is too short, and light rays compared to the curvature of the cornea right here. So we call that farsightedness. So in order to see, we have to start bending these light rays sooner in order so that they focus on the retina, and that's what we use a convex lens for, right? To start bending the light sooner before it hits the cornea right here, right? So light focuses before it did without correction. So right, that's how we correct for hyperopia, all right? But somebody might have an eyeball that's too long, right? Might have the retina way back over here someplace when their eyeball is way too long. And that can be corrected. That's called myopia or nearsightedness. Right? So light rays coming in focus way before the retina. So a concave lens is going to spread the light rays out so that when they get bent, right, they focus on the retina in this location right here. So concave is for myopia. Anything I want to say about that? No. Okay. Astigmatism is due to some kind of aspherical aberration in the cornea right here, so that maybe the top part of the cornea focuses light more than the bottom part, and so light coming in, the top part won't focus at the same location as light coming in from the lower part, of the cornea. And so the kind of lens that's necessary then is one that is what? Not symmetrical, is asymmetrical, to take care of astigmatism. So you have what we call an uneven lens right here. We'll correct for astigmatism. And you check for astigmatism in lab by looking at one of the figures, and you looked in all different areas without you would focus in the middle, and then hopefully everything around in that circle would be in focus. But if some parts of the circle are in focus and other parts aren't, then that would be an indication of some asymmetry of the cornea right here, producing that astigmatism. Okay. So besides these lenses that you can put in front of your eyes, there's another surgical procedure that's pretty nifty, but I wouldn't get too carried away with it because it's used mostly for cosmetic reasons, right? But it can really help somebody with really poor vision. What's the way that we can surgerize this eye right here so that you don't even need glasses? And is it a really drastic, radical kind of procedure? Okay, like the LASIK procedure. The LASIK procedure changes the shape of the cornea. And is it hard to access somebody's cornea?
No.
You know what? It's just right there in front of your face. That's the first thing that's touched, right? So you don't have to like dig around deep inside the eye. All right, as opposed to the lens, if you had to do some modifications to the lens, it's a little bit more difficult procedure because the lens is deeper inside your eye. All right, so what the LASIK procedure does is that it uses a laser to blast away just a couple cells on the surface of the cornea, actually just a kind of an inner layer of the cornea right here, and that changes the shape of the cornea, which then it bends light a little bit differently so that now it focuses on the retina properly. And so it's a pretty nifty procedure because somebody will have perfect vision in probably less than a second as a result of that procedure. But, of course, there can be complications. Maybe the computer malfunctions or somebody did some wrong measurements or something. And then your vision could be messed up, right, forever and ever. All right, so I would only do it for good medical reasons, not for cosmetic reasons. And there's other reasons, too. And that is, really quickly, as you get older, right, like, for instance, if I wanted to read something printed, what do you have to do when you're older? Okay, you got to hold it farther away, or you can take off your glasses that you use for far away distance. If you take your glasses off, right, things are in focus. But when I look far away, how are things? Is anybody there? Okay, you can't see things far away. So when you correct for far vision, what happens to your near vision? As you get older, it goes away, right? You can't correct for both with the same kind of lens correction anymore. So in order to see far away and close up at the same time, you need two different kinds of lenses. LASIK procedure can only make one kind of correction, and usually it's for far away. So when you get a LASIK procedure, and say if you're maybe in your early 30s or something, you'll have perfect vision far away, but in an instant, what will happen to your reading vision? It will go away completely. I've known a lot of people to get a LASIK procedure and they walk out of the doctor's office and all of a sudden the world is wonderful, everything in focus, and they get a phone call and they pick out their cell phone and look at it, and guess what? They can't use their cell phone because they can't see their cell phone anymore because it wipes out their near vision. All right, so then what would somebody need after that LASIK procedure? They need reading glasses immediately. So they've traded away seeing glasses for far away for reading glasses. So hopefully when you are interested in that kind of procedure, you talk to a physician that will tell you that kind of stuff. Right? Because it's really upsetting to not be able to use your cell phone anymore. Okay? All right, so what is actually adjusted when you get a LASIK procedure? That's the cornea right here. Right? So for cosmetic reasons, I don't think it's a really good thing, but if you're a professional athlete, like if you're a boxer, I wouldn't recommend going into the boxing ring with a pair of glasses on, right? And if you're getting paid a couple $1 million to go fight somebody, then I would spring for a LASIK procedure for sure. Or for instance, if your vision is so poor in the morning, or actually if your vision is so poor so that in the morning you can't even find your glasses, then the LASIK procedure is going to change your life, right? It will be a miracle for you. But you'll still need, what, reading glasses. At least you can kind of function during the day, yeah.
Does the shape of the cornea have to be critical on
All dimensions. Yeah, the curvature has to be, it has to match up to the curvature of your retina.
So after a person has like a cornea transplant, they have it like shaved off?
You know, I don't know how they match up a cornea. Yeah, they got to sew it back on there, and they'll probably need corrective lenses. I don't know if they would, if they're very good candidates for LASIK procedure or not. That's a little bit beyond my expertise. I would guess that when you get a corneal transplant, probably the most important consideration is the cross-matching of that tissue, right? Which one is the most compatible with the individual so that rejection is not an issue. Okay, and then secondarily is, does that cornea match up to the shape of somebody's retina? Because you can always correct that with lenses. So that's probably, if I were to order things, I'd probably think along those lines. Okay. All right, let's see, what time we got here? A couple more minutes. Well, we got to get through with this chapter. Dang, I don't know if we're going to get through with this chapter. All right, so we're going to talk about now vision. That's the reception of light rays. And that is due to the retina. So here's a picture of the retina. The photoreceptor cells are deep inside the retina, so the light actually comes in from the anterior part of the eye. It goes past all of these nerve fibers right here and ganglion cells, amacrine cells, and here are some of these bipolar cells. These are special sensory neurons. And then they even pass through these rod and cone cells, and these are the receptor cells for light. Right here, rods and cones. And you can see the cones are, this slide is a little funny. These cone cells should actually be smaller than the rod cells. The rod cells should actually be a lot bigger. The cone cells allow you to see color in, to see light in colors. And the rod cells right here allow you only to see black and white or shades of gray. Right, but because the cone cells are much smaller, they give you much better detail. You can see fine detail with cone cells. The rod cells, you can't see a lot of detail, but they're highly sensitive to even dim light conditions. Another way of saying that is that the cone cells can give you fine detail and color, but what has to be the intensity of the light? It has to be actually bright light. It has to be bright light. So in dim light, the cone cells don't work so well, but the rod cells can take over, but in dim light, you don't see colors very well as a result of that. And you don't see fine detail. Okay. Right, so here are the, and this is a better view of a cone cell and a rod cell. So you can see the rod cells are bigger than the cone cells. So there are a couple different parts to a rod cell. You have the inner segment that contains the cell body, and then some cytoplasm, and then you have the outer segment right here that contains the discs for these cells. And in the discs are where the pigment for light reception occurs. So what the heck is a pigment? Anybody know what a pigment is? What's a pigment? Yeah, a pigment is a chemical compound that can absorb light. Okay, so let's go back to our spectrum right here. Where's our spectrum? Right here. So a pigment is something that can absorb electromagnetic radiation, a particular energy level, and different energies. How do we perceive different energies of light? As different colors, right? So these are different energy levels. And so, for instance, plants outside have pigments in them. And what do those pigments look like to you? They look green, okay? So we call those green pigments. Now, what a green pigment is a molecule that can absorb, what did we call this over here? This is red, orange, yellow. So the pigment in plants can absorb these colors. And they can also absorb the blue, indigo, violet, because that light from the sun gets absorbed by those pigments and it gets converted into chemical energy. But the kind of wavelength that chlorophyll doesn't absorb is the green, so the plants reflect green back out of themselves because they don't absorb it. And what color light then do we perceive when we look at a plant that has chlorophyll in it? It looks green because the plant isn't absorbing the green wavelength. It's absorbing pretty much everything else. Okay, so we have pigments in our eyes that absorb these different energy levels right here, these different colors. And the rod cells, of course, can't tell the difference between the different colors. All right, so this is how that happens. All right, so the effect of light on the, and I'm only going to talk about rod cells in here, not the cone cells. All right, so rods are activated when light produces a chemical change in rhodopsin. So here is rhodopsin right here. It's made up of two kinds of chemicals. There's a protein that's opsin, and then there's this other chemical right here that's called retinol, and we put them together, we call that rhodopsin. And when light enters those discs in the outer segment of a rod cell, then it's going to change a conformation of this retinol right here, because it just so happens to have the right kinds of modes of changing shape that correspond to the energy of the light that's coming in. So it changes from this condition that has a bend in the retinol molecule. We call this a cis configuration right here, right? And when it absorbs light, it straightens out, and when this chain, this hydrocarbon chain straightens out, does it fit into the opsin molecule anymore? It like pops out of that active site, all right? So it dissociates from the opsin molecule. We call that a bleaching reaction, right? And that results in changes in permeability of ions in the membrane of those rod and cone cells, resulting in action potentials in the neurons in the retina. Okay, so the ganglion and amacrine cells produce action potentials. The rods and cones, the bipolar cells and horizontal cells produce generator potentials. And remember, generator potentials are just, what, graded potentials, right? The visual transduction system is inverse compared to many other sensory systems. So you're going to find this pretty fascinating to look at this. So most times when a receptor is stimulated, what's produced in a receptor? What is typically your understanding of stimulus? Like it's something that produces an EPSP. What is something that produces an EPSP? It's a depolarization, right? Which is what? Sodium entering the cell. That's classically how we understand that. Well, from these rod cells, though, we're going to see that it uses a different kind of way to produce stimulation or the perception of light. In the dark, is that with stimulus or without stimulus? In the dark, there is no light stimulus, right? The photoreceptors are actually depolarizing, and they release inhibitory neurotransmitter that hyperpolarizes the bipolar cells. All right? We're going to look at a nice illustration and then maybe go back over this again. But in the presence of stimulation, when there is light, right? Light inhibits the photoreceptor cells, the rods and cone cells, from releasing inhibitory neurotransmitter, and thus that stimulates the bipolar cells. So light stimulates bipolars by inhibiting the rod cells as a result. Right, so the rods and cones contain many sodium channels that are open in the dark. So in the dark, what's happening to the rod and cone cells? Or in particular, let's just say rod cells. What's happening in the dark? If the sodium channels are open, they are being stimulated, right? They're being stimulated in the dark, which is not, I think, normally what we would suspect. And so this depolarizing sodium current, right, is what we call the dark current, and that happens in the dark. So the rod cells are depolarizing under dark conditions. Light, on the other hand, closes those sodium channels and causes hyperpolarization. So that's really strange. So here is the mechanism by which that happens. And you know what? I think we might have to start here next time. Okay? It has to do with our friend, the G protein, working through a second messenger, okay, which is going to be cyclic GMP, activating or deactivating sodium channels. All right, so you might want to look at this slide for next time, as well as this one right here, because I think, you know what, both of these are probably exam figures. This one here and this one here too. All right, so, and also come with some questions for next time as well.